Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in rural South Carolina, and at age 6 made a life-changing decision. Move in with his grandparents because they had books. He went on to receive a BS and an MS from Howard University and an MA and a PhD from Wharton School of Business. In 1997, he became Wayne State University's 9th president in its 140 years of existence. In 2006, Ernst & Young named him its Entrepreneur of the Year in the Supporter of Entrepreneur category. His name, Dr. Irvin Reed. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Dr. Irvin Reed, the president of Wayne State University. Doctor, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
It's nice being here. Thank you very much for having me.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Yes. First of all, I lived with my parents in Pawleys Island, South Carolina, until I was just around the age of 6. And during the summers, I remember probably from as early as the age of 4 or 5, I would visit my grandparents during the summer months, and then would go back to my mother and father in Pawleys Island. My grandparents lived in McClellanville. My grandfather was a minister. But the fascinating things about being at my grandfather's house with my aunts and uncles and my grandmother were all of the books. And all of the books really was a complete set of the World Book Encyclopedia. I don't know if you remember that, but there was all of these red books, these volumes with gold lettering on them. It's just fascinating. And I loved going through those. Obviously at 3 and 4, I wasn't reading, but I was looking at a lot of pictures. I looked at the comic strips on Sunday morning, sitting on the floor with my parents, with my grandparents as they read the newspaper. So I found out there's a lot more was going on there with my grandparents. So I decided at the age of 6 or shortly thereafter that I really wanted to spend the school year or the longest period of time with my grandparents and then visit my parents. And everyone went along with that. So I lived with my grandparents. I was brought up by my grandparents and my aunts and uncles and all those books.
Your grandmother was a school teacher in a two-room schoolhouse.
That's correct. So when I started, I spent my first year of formal school, what was probably preschool or kindergarten, whatever the equivalent was then, with my parents. And then after that, I went to school in my grandmother's two-room schoolhouse. The fascinating thing about the two-room schoolhouse, however, is that my grandmother was the teacher in both rooms. Because in the morning, she would have the younger children, which is the group that I was in. And afterwards, in the afternoon, those children went home, and the older children who were there stayed a longer day. And my grandmother had to go over into that classroom and to teach them. And so I didn't have a way to go home because I rode with my grandmother. And so I went over to the older kids. So I had kind of a condoed education morning and afternoon.
What did your mom and dad do?
They were laborers. My father worked for the International Paper Company in Georgetown, South Carolina. My mother did a lot of individual work, things that she created, and stayed at home and looked after us. There were only two of us.
How can a mom instill a passion for reading and learning in a child?
Well, it's a challenge today because, of course, reading has a number of challenges. People listen. They see multimedia presentation of information that before could only be presented through reading. And now the important thing, of course, is the learning. How does the learning take place? How is it most effective? I love to think that that is through reading, but I also have to allow that there are other ways that it happens as well. I am sort of old-fashioned in that regard. I don't like to read books by listening to them on tape. I like to still handle the pages of the book. But I could fully understand in this rather changed world that children may see their parents themselves not reading books, but being exposed to what's in those books. And so I think it's extremely important that we understand that the purpose of why we take any of these media is to learn.
You got a Bachelor of Science, and a Master of Science from Howard University. And you were born in rural South Carolina. How did you ever get from rural South Carolina to Howard University?
Well, a train ride from Charleston, South Carolina. As I left my parents very early on, started with my grandparents, I continued on even when I was in middle school and as I was in junior high school and moving on to high school. And my mother at that time and my father had separated. My mother was living in Charleston, South Carolina. So I graduated from high school in Charleston. And I took a train ride to Washington, D.C. to go to Howard University in order to study a lot of things that I didn't study. I was going to be the greatest chemist that ever lived. I was going to be this or the other. I ended up with my first degree in psychology and then my master's in psychology. And those are the two degrees you referred to.
You then got two more degrees from the Wharton School of Business. Where'd you ever come up with the money to get all these degrees?
Well, believe you me, it was not from our own resources. It was a lot of borrowing and begging and pleading with people and taking advantage of scholarships. And when I first went to Wharton, quite frankly, my wife and I couldn't afford to pay the tuition there for me. So I took only two courses. And they realized that was not the way to go. And they worked out something where I got a job on campus. But this is in my master's and my doctoral program at the Wharton School. And then when I got to the point of doing my dissertation, I got a dissertation award that allowed me to spend time on collecting of data and analyzing the results and finishing up the degree. It took a while, by the way.
In 1989, you become the CEO of Montclair State University. Can you tell us about that experience?
It was Montclair State College at the time, and I just went there and took a look at what they were offering and said, this is not a college. This is a university. They have bachelor's degrees in a number of different areas. Why is this a college? So I started trying to redefine the institution, and it was a very unusual way of getting there. But how I got there was I had been dean of the business school at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and so I was never vice president of the university, so I went from being the dean to being the president of Montclair State University.
We're talking to Dr. Irvin Reed. When we come back, we'll ask him how it was he got to Wayne State University. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Irvin Reed. And, Doctor, on November 24th, 1997, you become the ninth president in Wayne State University's 140 years of existence. You guys stay a long time.
Yes, yes. Well, it's a great institution. It has been from the very beginning. You know, Wayne State has a very unique beginning. It started as a medical school. And the rest of the university effectively grew up around that. Most universities start as a liberal arts college, and then after that they will add probably some science, and then after that there will maybe one professional program in one of those. But Wayne State was different. It started with medicine and then education. The three earlier parts of Wayne State were medicine, education, and athletics, believe it or not.
33,000 students today. 2,500 are international students. It's the third largest university in the state of Michigan. 11 schools, 350 academic programs. Tell us about what makes the thing so unique and so great.
Well, what is very unique about the place is that it's its location. Here in the heart of Detroit, it is truly not only an urban university in location, however, it is also in content. You know, many urban universities, and I won't name them, are in the middle of cities, but they're sort of barricaded there. They're sort of fortresses within the city. Wayne State is open to the city of Detroit. As a matter of fact, when I arrived in 97, I noticed there were some chain links all around the campus for a purpose of chaining people around, and I removed them because I felt that it gave the wrong symbol to what the university should be in the city. I also noticed that all of the buildings that were constructed had their backs turned to the city. They face inside the inner quarter of the campus. That was the orientation. So every building that I have been involved in since 97, you'll notice now, if they're on the periphery of the building, face out to the community. It says welcome. We built a welcome center right out there at the corner of Woodward and Warren. And the purpose of the welcome center was so that when, excuse me, when someone came to the university, they didn't have to spend the time to get the services they needed by going deep into the bowels of the place. It was right there on the periphery of the campus saying welcome. And so the university's role here is that of aiding the city of Detroit, but also facilitating its own research and teaching and learning by taking advantage of the city. Well, look at where we're located, right near the DIA, right near the Historical Museum, the medical centers, Henry Ford and the Detroit Medical Center. All of these things are part of the learning experience of Wayne State University students, and that's what makes it unique as an educational institution.
Going forward, you have a four-point strategic vision. Point number one, you have an urban mission. Mm-hmm. You've talked about that. You want to expound on that at all?
Well, no, except to say that this is fundamental to what we offer. I tell people from the suburbs or from another state, you can come to Wayne State University and stay in the classroom for 4 years and get a phenomenal education, but you will not necessarily have gotten an urban education if you did not take part of the other things that the city has to offer. I also kiddingly used to say that, quite frankly, I like the business I'm in because 80% of all the learning that takes place in a university should be outside of the classroom, which means that I'm only have to deliver on 20% of it in the classroom. But that, what I mean by that is that people should be engaged in the city of where the university is located.
Point number two of your strategic vision is your global presence.
Extraordinarily important, again, for all universities now, but something that we have taken advantage of. Wayne State University, you mentioned earlier, has 2,500 international students. It's one of the largest international in terms of proportion in the university. It's actually probably closer to 3,000. Before 9/11, it exceeded 10% of the entire enrollment of the university. There was obviously a dip following 9/11, but that's been rebuilding. But the faculty is an international faculty. While we have students from more than 125 countries, we also have faculty members from a large number of countries, not just graduate students who've come here to study and are teaching. These are regular tenure track senior faculty member researchers as a part of the university. And this is an extraordinarily important thing for us to do. Furthermore, from 1997, we had six programs, study abroad programs. We now have nearly 40 study abroad programs. We have students now who are going, and I'd like to see us increase our students who are studying abroad by as much 10% per year.
Point number three of the strategic vision, your use of innovative technology.
Technology is so important now for students in terms of how they learn. They use technology sometime in a very aggressive way, even ahead of us, those of us who are constructing the curriculum at the university. It's extremely important if they come to work here at the radio station or if they go and work in industry. We want them to be on the most updated use of technology of any of the students that would report to those businesses or activities.
The last point of the vision, your commitment to diversity.
Yes. The diversity is a part of what I've stated earlier about our international students, our students from the urban landscape, our students from the suburbs, our students from elsewhere in the nation. We draw heavily from the tri-county area around where Wayne State is located. But we also have expanded, depending on the school or the college or the program, throughout the world. And one of the things that brings to the university is an opportunity opportunity for all students to interact with people who go beyond their immediate environment. One student said, "I like this place because this is the place where you can come here and you could talk to an international student in the morning, and you talk to an African American student in the afternoon, or you can talk to a young lady who comes from a very conservative religious background." All of this going on within a very small period of time. It could be in the fitness center, in the classroom, in the student center. And that diversity makes our university.
In the 10 years you've been here, how have the students changed?
Well, they're much more savvy. They are, I sometimes call them minimalists because they always want to know is how many pages this paper. Maybe we all always ask that. But they also are much more focused on the benefits of their learning to what they want to do in life. That's both positive and negative. I used to think that the university was a place that you would go in order to learn ideas, to be exposed to ideas, and then to adapt them to the challenges you had later in life. There's much more of an immediacy in the students. I see much more urgency in what they want to do and what they expect of college.
We're talking to Dr. Irvin Reed. When we'll come back, we'll continue to talk about the young people today and their future. I'm Jack Grasula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Dr. Irvin Reed, who in 2000 was named a Michiganian of the Year by the Detroit News. Doctor, the young people today, you're the ninth president in 140 years of Wayne State University. The young people today, if they stay at a job 2-3 years, they're one of the longest tenured people, young people. As a leader, how do you handle that?
Well, it's one of the changes that we deal with. Their goals in life are somewhat different from the goals that you and I may have had, or those who preceded us. They are not looking for longevity or seniority in a position. They're looking for an experience, for advancement, and for moving on to another experience or advancement. And so it gives us some challenges in the university, because what are we preparing them for? Are we preparing them to be engineers or literature teachers? Or are we preparing them to be thinkers, to be adaptable to the environments in which they find themselves? And therefore, the latter is more the case, certainly as a university. But a quick story. The president of Cornell University once told me that he thinks that we should seriously consider offering college degrees that come with expiration dates, that the knowledge we give them this year are totally useless 5 years from now. So what are we teaching them? We're teaching them how to acquire knowledge throughout their lifetime of thinking, of doing things, and repositioning themselves. So that's why I think that it's challenging what the young people they're doing, and it's challenging to us as educators.
I've heard that, you know, the brain is a muscle, and like any other muscle, you've got to keep using it, mm-hmm. or it withers.
That's right.
Every year, 15,000 Detroit City students enter the ninth grade. A little more than 30% of them will earn a high school degree, mm-hmm. and only 4% will earn a college degree. What's the answer?
Well, we have identified some of the answers. The question now is, how do we mass produce it? There are all kinds of things you can do on a small scale, but we've got to figure out how to do those on a larger scale. We have a program at Wayne State that's called Math Corps. We have another one that's called Go Girls. These are programs that are focusing on use of math and science and technology as learning devices. But you don't have to be a math geek to participate in the program. You've got to go.
We're talking to Dr. Irvin Reed. When we'll come back, we're going to go into detail about Go Girls and the Math Corps. I'm Jack Grasula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Dr. Irvin Reed. Doctor, can you tell us about Math Corps?
Math Corps is a fascinating program. It's been going on at the university more than 12 years. And we take students somewhere around the 7th grade, the Detroit public school system, primarily, but they could come from other places as well. And what it does is that it forms teams of students working together for a common purpose of solving mathematical problems. But they don't have to; they aren't handpicked. These aren't students that have been chosen because they are good at math. But what they are good at is working together, stimulating each other, challenging each other, competing, and learning, and involving the parents in the program as well. Because the purpose of the program really is to build a certain amount of individual integrity and strength. And this program we run mostly in the summer. The large groups of them come and they go throughout the summer working on these projects. And it's really exciting. We have enthusiastic faculty members. Now, remember, we're talking about 7th graders. I'm a university that's primarily focused on people who finished university and want to go on for a 4-year degree and then a master's degree and a PhD. But we're finding out, Jack, that we have to do more to try to prepare those students for coming for that college education. So we're experimenting. And that's what essentially Math Corps is. It's an experiment. We've got to figure out how to put the Math Corps into the public school system, into the charter schools, into the private schools on a mass scale, because that kind of camaraderie is important for building an educational environment, but it takes a lot of time. Now, I'll give you just one statistic. Our estimate is that if we took that 7th grader and left him in the Detroit public school system for the rest of his or her formal education, that only 42% of them will graduate. Not a number dissimilar from the number you used earlier. Will graduate from high school. That 42%, if you took some of those students and put them in Math Corps, that at the end of their 12 years, 90% of them, in excess of 90% of them, will graduate from high school. 90% compared to 42%. 95%. 90% of them will actually graduate from college compared to the 600 number or the small percentage you mentioned. So we've got to figure out how to make these things that we know how to do work on a larger scale.
I spent a day this summer in Math Corps, and I'm in a room. I was a math major in college.
Mm-hmm.
And the professor, this is all with no pen, no paper, gets up and says, all right, a little quiz. 6,028 plus 2,043 plus 14,136 divided by the sixth power. Then add 1,028,000.
Mm-hmm.
This goes on another minute or two.
Right.
And 40 arms.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are 7th, 8th, 9th graders.
Right.
They all go up.
Right.
And 90% of the kids had the right answer.
Right.
Phenomenal.
With enthusiasm, right?
You must handpick these kids.
No, we do not. They are not handpicked. The only thing we ask is that the parents make a commitment to participate in the program with them.
How do you do it?
It's a method that has been developed nationally and that's been adapted at Wayne State. And we have committed faculty members who have felt very strongly that these kids were capable of handling math. They felt that before they were dismissed, but they figured out a way to do it. And it's important. But again, it's a relatively small scale. We're talking about 200, 250 people. What is it? The Detroit Public School System, we have, 190,000? 180,000, maybe fewer today, but we've got to figure out a way to fix the public school system so that education is an engaging for all of the students of the city of Detroit as it is for those students in Math Corps and in Go Girls and in engineering, Girls in Engineering, and many of the other programs that we have at Wayne State that we are focusing on that, because the graduate students in engineering and the PhDs in math and in science find this fascinating, but this is not their primary mission. Our primary mission is to prepare them at the college level, but we know there's a problem and we can share some of that expertise, but it requires a systemic change to get a Math Corps technique adapted throughout the system in the city of Detroit or any major school system.
can you tell us about Go Girls?
Yes. Well, Go Girls is a fascinating program. Actually, it was started by my wife here in Detroit when she was at the University of Michigan, a program that was actually at the University of Michigan that she became involved in, and she brought it here to the city of Detroit. One thing happens with girls in math and science classes, if they're very smart, the boys say things about them like they are not very attractive, and so they then begin to do what? Withdraw. So they're going to show, well, I'm not going to show that I'm smart, because if I show that I'm smart, then they'll think I'm not attractive, and I don't want that. So one thing we've figured out in Go Girls is that if we take the girls and put them in a different program, working just with themselves, they actually learn better in math and science. And so that's a program that's just one of several programs that we have at the university. It runs on Saturdays. It's run by one of our professors now that my wife is no longer involved in the program on a day-to-day basis, by Professor Sally Robinson. And it is an extraordinary program. Again, too small. We can only take about 40 to 60 in a group, and we need to do this in about 400 to 600 and even more to get a program like this to truly to have an impact throughout, a systemic impact in the city of Detroit.
A lot of people have recently been offered buyouts in this state. What do you say to a 40-year-old that says, you know, they've given me the offer to go back to school, but doctor, I can't go back to school. I'm 40 years old.
Well, I think that this person can go back to school because he is 40 years old, or she is 40 years old. The university is very welcoming to people. Remember, this will shock you, but you know what the average age of a student at Wayne State University is? It's 29. That's the average age. It's now probably over 30, because I'm talking about three-year-old statistics. So therefore, that means that about a lot of those people are older than 29, and only some of them are younger than 29. We have graduate students. We have undergraduate students. We have moms who never finished college, who took some courses first year and who want to come back. We have men and fathers who have felt that they wanted to take a new direction. People who really wanted to get just a certificate. There are all kinds of things, but they have to take the first step. And that first step is to come to the Welcome Center, to come to the university, talk to a faculty member, a dean, a counselor, or an advisor, and before making up this mind in the isolation of your own home, and before you spend all of that money that you've got as a part of the buyout, you really need to restructure not only your finances, but your intellect and your vocation.
In today's world, you have to keep learning while you're earning. What's the university trying to do to keep this eternal learning for these people that have to keep learning new technologies?
Well, that's the thing that we're all about, because many of the students who come back to us are fully engaged in a career, but they understand that they must keep their skills up. They must always be ahead of the curve. They come back for a master's degree. Sometimes they don't even come back for a degree. They come back for a certificate. And we offer that to them very widely. And there's one other way they can access it very quickly. Remember the technology I told you that was the foundation of what I was trying to do? We do a lot of things online. A large part of our nursing program is online. There's still some of it in the classroom. There are other programs that are offering things. Once they're in the school, many of them communicate with their faculty members through our technology at the university, through Pipeline or Blackboard, or many of these technologies that you and I probably wouldn't know. You probably thought a blackboard was something which you wrote on with white chalk. Well, now our students will look at us and laugh the same way they would laugh at a vinyl record as a source of music.
How is globalization changing Wayne State University?
There's so much that's going on. For example, we're looking now at offering programs abroad in collaboration with other institutions and universities in other countries. We've just completed an agreement with a university in India where the students there will study and will actually never come to the United States. Our faculty members will go there for part of it. We will have some of our faculty training their faculty there, and some of it will be done, again, through technology.
We're talking to Dr. Irvin Reed, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Irvin Reed, who in 2006 was named by Ernst & Young, an Entrepreneur of the Year, in the Supporter Entrepreneurship category. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Who are your heroes, Doctor?
Well, they change, but I'll talk about my enduring heroes, and I think that the one that immediately comes to mind, and the one I've been talking about, I think, since 1986, when I gave my first commencement speech, is Nelson Mandela, a man who made extraordinary sacrifice for little personal gain himself, and had a life commitment, and was willing to, to essentially, as he said, "I've lived for freedom, but I will die for freedom." And I think that this is an extraordinary individual, Dag Hammarskjöld. Who was one of the early Secretary General of the United Nations, and preceded Kofi Annan by a number of individuals in between, but an individual who worked tirelessly for peace and traveled around the world trying to build the peace for what was happening in Africa at the time, and all of the colonial powers were leaving and wanted to role the United Nations to play a role. Ralph Bunche, one of the early undersecretaries of the United Nations from the United States, who did tremendous thing in trying to bring peace to the Israelis and the Arabs very early on, before this more region in the 40s, late 40s and 50s. Stevie Wonder, a man who took music to a level, in spite of his individual limitations and tragedies in life. You know, he was in a car accident and lost yet another sense of smell, although he was also blind. But look at what he does in terms of the human spirit. Those are the people that I think about a great deal.
Who are the heroes of your students today?
Well, that's a different question, and I didn't mention any of my sports heroes, and for many of my students today, I'd have to mention many of their sports heroes, it's kind of regrettable. I was looking at something recently having to do with the difference between Chinese students and American students, and who they think about as their heroes, and the Chinese students are thinking Bill Gates, and this group of American students, I looked across the aisle, I was on a plane, and the young woman was reading People magazine, and the cover story was on Britney Spears. And I think there is a big difference in terms of what are the personalities. Now, why is this difference in heroes of my generation and students today? It has to do with the media, the exposure. Who is on the mass media? Those are those are the people our students see, and those are the ones that they adapt more easily as heroes. If they could learn more about the heroes, the scientists, the people who are really looking at embryonic stem cell and the potential it has for relieving the pain and misery of so many people, I think those would be their heroes, but they are not on the covers of People magazine.
Doctor, what can a parent do today to get their child to alter his or her heroes?
Well, I think that the parents themselves have to play a much more directive role of talking about these people. You know, the dinner table used to be the place where the discussions about heroes and national figures and presidential activities would take place. I remember listening to my grandfather, who was a big influence in my life, sitting on the back porch reading the newspaper to my grandmother. My grandmother was the teacher, but my grandfather was always the one that read the newspapers. And I listened to the people he would mention. And Harry Truman was his hero. And how did I know that? Because whenever there was an article in the newspaper about Harry Truman, his voice would elevate himself. And that's what I knew. I began to respect Harry Truman as president, decisive, a CEO that really made decisions, you know. If you can't take the heat, you do what? You get out of the kitchen. I mean, these are the kinds of things that I remember from my grandfather's heroes. And I don't know that our own, the parents of our kids today talk enough about their heroes to them, or unfortunately their heroes to us sports figures.
What have your students taught you and continue to teach you?
The extraordinarily ability of an individual to adapt to technology. they have used technology in ways that I could never imagine. The iPod, which was supposed to be a source of music, is now a source of news. They download videos. They download all kinds of things to the iPod in ways that I could never have thought of. I bought an iPod, and I put all the operas that I own on it, and that's all I did with it. But there are podcasts that are extraordinary ways of obtaining information. Same thing with other technologies, the adaptability. What I would like to think, though, there'd be less use of these just games playing with technology and more of the creativity that I admire so much in the young people today.
Is the American dream still alive?
Absolutely. Alive and widely available to so many people. You know, there's always discrimination in our society. There are always inequities. John F. Kennedy, I think, said, you know, there are all kinds of inequities in life. And there are some, but we've gone so far to remove some of the legal barriers or the legal vehicles of inequality. I think that now that we have those barriers removed, there are more opportunities. Unfortunately, not everyone has moved along as quickly to take advantage of the American dream, and we still have to take care of some of the structural problems in the society as well as some of the individual drive.
You lead an organization with 33,000 students, hundreds of professors. What do you do all day?
I think about 33,000 students and hundreds of professors. Excuse me. It's much of my job is really thinking about how to move the university forward, how to get resources in what have been diminishing resources in the environment. But you know, you have to recognize something about a president of a university, and that's this. Think about the university as a successful parade going by, and I'm the guy who grabbed the baton and jumped in front of it. That's what a president is. That's what leadership is all about.
Recently, Wayne State University, the U of M, and the MSU have started a research quarter. Can you talk about that?
Yes, this is a very important initiative on the part of the three research universities. You know, research universities have in the past all spent a lot of time competing with each other. The state is giving us all money. We should think of ways of using the resources of the state more efficiently. So President Mary Sue Coleman, President Luana Simon, and myself got together and said, let's form this research corridor and coordinate our activities. Let the state know what we are doing, but also let the people in the state understand how we can help them working together, the three of us working with them. We have a website. That website is very important for our faculty members. Our faculty members need to know what the faculty members of U of M are doing and what Michigan State are doing. We need to communicate that to people in Washington so we could collaborate and get funding for federal dollars coming back to the state. We need to be able to coordinate when something like the Pfizer announcement that took place just the other day. Each of us can go individually, or we could go together, or we can do a combination of those things. But those are the kinds of things that we're doing, and it is very important, and I think you will be hearing more and more about the University Research Corridor.
We have 1 minute left. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I think it's very important for them to understand the criticality of education in their lives. They need to understand that education is a lifetime pursuit, and that every moment of their life must be spent in understanding how they are going to be focusing on this information or this technique, helping them to become better people, better citizens, and later on in life, better parents, and to build a better family, an immediate family, and a family which extends beyond the immediate family throughout their community. They are responsible for Detroit, for Michigan, for the United States, and indeed the world. We are a global society. They play a critical role in building it and keeping it safe and keeping it healthy. So I want them to understand the secret to that is the knowledge that they acquire and how they apply it to the solutions of the problems and the needs of the human race.
I want to thank you for coming on tonight, and I want to thank you for the role that you and your team does. you're one of the most important lifelines in this area's future.
Thank you very much.
Our guest next Sunday will be the president of AT&T Michigan, Gail Toriano. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.